Chapter 10. The hands of all the 4,000 electric clocks in all the Bloomsbury Centre's 4,000 rooms marked 27 minutes past two. This hive of industry, as the director was fond of calling it, was in the full buzz of work. Everyone was busy, everything in ordered motion. Under the microscopes, their long tails furiously lashing, the spermatozoa were burrowing headfirst into eggs, and, fertilized, the eggs were expanding, dividing, or if Bokanovskified, budding and breaking up into whole populations of separate embryos. From the social predestination room, the escalators went rumbling down into the basement, and there, in the crimson darkness, stewingly warm on their cushion of peritoneum, and gorged with blood surrogate and hormones, the fetuses grew and grew, or, poisoned, languished into a stunted epsilon hood. With a faint hum and rattle, the moving racks crawled imperceptibly through the weeks and the recapitulated eons to where, in the decanting room, the newly unbottled babes uttered their first yell of horror and amazement. The dynamos purred in the sub-basement. The lifts rushed up and down. On all the 11 floors of nurseries, it was feeding time. From 1,800 bottles, 1,800 carefully labelled infants were simultaneously sucking down their pint of pasteurized external secretion. Above them, in 10 successive layers of dormitory, the little boys and girls who were still young enough to need an afternoon sleep were as busy as everyone else, though they did not know it, listening unconsciously to hypnopedic lessons in hygiene and sociability, in class consciousness and toddler's love life. Above these again were the playrooms where, the weather having turned to rain, 900 older children were amusing themselves with brick and clay modelling, hunt the zipper, and erotic play. Buzz, buzz, the hive was humming busily, joyfully. Blithe was the singing of the young girls over their test tubes. The predestinators whistled as they worked, and in the decanting room what glorious jokes were cracked above the empty bottles. But the director's face, as he entered the fertilizing room with Henry Foster, was grave, wooden with severity. "A public example," he was saying. "In this room, because it contains more high-caste workers than any other in the centre, I have told him to meet me here at 2:30.
"He does his work very well," put in Henry with hypocritical generosity.
"I know, but that's all the more reason for severity. His intellectual eminence carries with it corresponding moral responsibilities. The greater a man's talents, the greater his power to lead astray. It is better that one should suffer than that many should be corrupted. Consider the matter dispassionately, Mr. Foster, and you will see that no offence is so heinous as unorthodoxy of behaviour. Murder kills only the individual, and after all, what is an individual?"
With a sweeping gesture, he indicated the rows of microscopes, the test tubes, the incubators.
"We can make a new one with the greatest ease, as many as we like. Unorthodoxy threatens more than the life of a mere individual. It strikes at society itself. Yes, at society itself," he repeated. "Ah, but here he comes.